Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to this Free CP number 114. I'm very happy to have you here with me. Excuse the windy background sounds. I don't know whether you can hear those or not. We've got another winter storm raging here at the moment. Winter can be somewhat of a trial sometimes in the hilly parts of the British countryside. But hey, we don't live here because life is calm and convenient. I'd be living in Dubai if that was true. No, we live here for the prolonged bouts of rain and high taxes, of course. Only joking. There's a price to pay for the privilege of living in the British countryside. It's been an open secret for hundreds of years. Just Google John Constable or William Turner if you don't believe me. Anyway, back to today. And I'm speaking to a gentleman who, whilst I haven't actually asked him, I would say almost certainly would align with my admiration of 18th century art. Alex Voss is a former investment banker, current Austrian economist, and what I would call one of the OGs of the Free Cities space. He's a senior advisor at the Free Cities Foundation and the CFO of Tipolis, which is Titus Gabel's company building Free Cities. He's been there since its inception, in fact. He's also written, as far as I know, the only book in existence about Bitcoin and Free Cities, Strategies for Liberty, which is a good way to sum up our conversation, I would say. Anyway, let's see what my underpaid and overworked AI slave thinks. In this episode, we dive into the intersection of Bitcoin and Free Cities, exploring how these two concepts can work together to foster economic freedom and innovation. Alex Voss shares insights from his extensive experience in developing autonomous urban environments and the financial strategies that underpin them. The conversation covers the challenges of creating free cities in the current geopolitical climate, discussing the importance of regulatory autonomy and the potential for these cities to thrive alongside Bitcoin as a currency of choice. Alex emphasizes the necessity of building a strong community that supports and benefits from these innovative projects, whilst also addressing the complexities of negotiating with host governments. We also explore the role of digital nomads and families in shaping the future of free cities and how market urbanism can lead to the creation of vibrant, sustainable communities. Throughout the discussion, Alex provides a nuanced perspective on the potential trajectory of free cities over the next 50 to 100 years, balancing optimism with realism in a world fraught with uncertainty. Not bad, AI. Now get back in your cage. Only joking, my AI is currently sitting on my lap, purring, and I'm stroking it. It's very happy, don't worry. So yes, Alex reveals what he knows about creating free cities, and I'm just sitting there soaking it up, as I hope you will too. He certainly knows his stuff. Anyway, onwards and upwards. No Nosta comments today. Just some shout outs to our supporters who are certainly helping the Free CP SBR to swell in size. Do you remember what that is? The Free Cities Podcast Strategic Bitcoin Reserve. Yeah, well, you do now anyway. Thanks to Nathan Day, Justin Bianchi, Matthias, Crypto Connect, Sam21, Anon and On. Anon and On, thank you all. Thanks for your input. Future looks bright from here, even if the weather doesn't. In fact, I'd say it's a perfect day to go and collect some of that seasoned 18th century oak tree wood that fell 2 years ago in the storms. Pack it into the wood burner, toss in a match, pull up that lovely restored antique wingback armchair, and just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Alex Voss. I'd quite like to know, this is purely personal, what you get up to at Tipolis as well. because you've spoken a lot in the past about strategies for getting all this stuff up and running, and you've been in the space for as long as anyone, really, I suppose. There were only a few people at the beginning, weren't there?
Yep.
And you were one of them. So why don't you, Alex, give us a bit of a who are you first?
Sure. I'm Alex Voss. I'm the CFO of Tipalus. I am also on the board of the Free Cities Foundation. My role with Tipalus is largely as the finance and on the business side of things. It is very much focused on taking these aspirations, these ideas, these plans, and futuristic sorts of scenarios, and figuring out if, how, and when we can actually make this work. So in the past, I've often spoken about the business model of this. Why would people invest? These sorts of questions. How can you actually finance the development of a huge city? This year, I focused a bit more on bringing energy to new cities. So I think the sort of through line is that I'm focused on how are we executing on these big aspirations that many people come to the conference and participate in these sorts of discussions about and sort of inspire us.
We were talking just before I switched everything on, really about, and it was in about the business model, I suppose, because this is a fledgling industry. We know that. We know how many projects there are that are actually executing on their plans, and we know how many there are in the pipeline. And there seem to be a hell of a lot in the pipeline. And this seems to be the kind of the one fly in the ointment of this whole process. And it's obvious why. You know, you can't just suddenly start creating autonomous places around the world, especially in the current climate of, geopolitical events. I think it's even more suspect if you're a state. It's like, what do these people want? But one of my theories, I suppose, is that is a gradually then suddenly theory. And it's easy to predict that that's what would happen, because you only need one or two or three or four that are actually really killing it and everyone's going, wow, look at this, before this kind of thing really, a bit in the same way that special economic zones, there's what now 6,000 special economic zones around the world. All right, they're not all working, but somebody somewhere has realized that this is a good idea. What's your opinion on the kind of trajectory of the free cities? Like, is it a gradually then suddenly kind of thing?
The gradually part, 100%. This is, more or less an observable fact. It is very gradual. It's very, very difficult. Not just geopolitical tensions, but historical interventions in countries, in particular my home country of the United States, has intervened in a lot of foreign countries. This has resulted in a very concerned view for this concept of sovereignty. Now, free cities, of course, are not going for sovereignty. Nonetheless, this is simply an association that exists as soon as we are speaking with governments. And it's very difficult to get around, in particular because of historical things that have taken place. I do think you're right. I think the special economic zone industry is probably the correct way to look at this. It's probably, very, very gradually. And then once there's some success, this model is replicated. It's hard to imagine, though, that it's quite as suddenly and as expansive as the special zone industry. I'm not sure there will be 6,000 of them ever. You could imagine that each of the, call it 195 or 200 countries in the world, maybe they have 3 to 5, or most of them do. So, I mean, this is putting some sort of an upper bound on the amount of free cities that would potentially ever exist, I guess, in my model. But that doesn't mean, that it can't expand very quickly, and I think it will. I think already we've seen this to some degree just in my sort of private discussions with governments, is that once there's something to point to, once there's an actual place you can bring people to, show them these are real people building real buildings, some people are living there, they're starting businesses, in some cases very, very innovative businesses, it's a lot easier to express what this idea is. It's very abstract, and you have to concretize it in order to really sell it to many government officials, in my experience.
That's interesting. You said 2 to 3 in each country in the future. I was just thinking about that. What kind of, imagine there are 3 free cities in your country. That's going to create an interesting dynamic, isn't it? I'm just thinking Dubai, for example, in a way. Dubai is like a whole thing's a special economic zone now. You know what I mean? It's like, it's got all these free zones and it's got all these things, but people don't live in, they come to Dubai, mm-hmm. You know. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about? 2 to 3 zones? Otherwise, it could be quite a divisive thing. It's like you've got 3 places in a country where everyone's just having the time of their lives, free from regulation or, you know, less regulation, probably better taxes. And then you've got the rest of the country walking around grumpy, you know.
Well, I think that, theoretically that's possible. The reason why I said, just a limited few in many countries is typically that's their interest, the country's interest. They're often a little bit disinterested in creating this opportunity for what I call the Swiss cheesing of their country, where it just anyone can create one of these sort, creating like the Zetas do a Zeta framework, and then anyone can more or less set up a Zeta. Of course, there's certain stipulations and it has to go through camp, but you can have as many as you'd like. You can annex new properties in these sorts of things. And this creates a, especially related to that sovereignty topic, a very interesting dynamic where, you have national police, for example, working throughout the country, but there are special areas and it's hard to know beforehand because it's updating all the time and it's sort of at random where these zones are, where certain rules apply. And I can imagine for some level of order, that's relatively difficult to manage. And the other, point that I would make is that I'm not so sure it would be quite as divisive as you make it out to be, because the prosperity that's created in a free city is certainly focused in the free city, but in no ways is it exclusive to the free city. Monaco is in many ways a free city, and you can see the repercussions of Monaco in that some of the wealthiest areas of all of France are the little belt that surrounds Monaco. And this is because it creates good jobs. It creates, people with money are investing them in businesses. They're starting new things. They're creating new opportunities for people. And this allows people to thrive. And that's the whole point of the free city. So you could very much imagine that actually the areas surrounding would all also be quite pleased to have these sorts of things with the opportunity it creates.
We've been talking a lot about that actually recently, about the sort of the different methods you have in establishing the longevity of a free city, like the legal, the kind of economic incentives. But then there's this other one, which is everyone on board with this? Like the more people you've got on board, the better. And I think, from what I've worked out from talking to people, the strategy is build fast and benefit everyone around you as quickly as possible. That's the strategy, is to do that. And in a way, I think that's one of the big lessons from Prospera. I've been there. I'm not saying that the project is at fault at all. It's just that, they're at the cutting end of the wedge and I'm observing what's going on. But I was thinking, there are so many ways to, not that the surrounding areas are in, pissed off anyway. They don't appear to be. Obviously, there's a few people that don't like it, a few people that do, But adding value to them, building a hospital in your free city that everyone can use, energy provider, which, Roatan's got a terrible energy provider that everyone hates. These kind of things are one of the, probably, when I think about it, best strategies to secure your city. Because we've seen in Honduras, the legal stuff is all very well until you get, a far left-wing government coming in and saying, we're just going to screw the whole thing. Screw you, screw the legal, screw everything. We're going to go full communist now, and there's nothing you can do about it, kind of thing.
I think you're exactly right. I think in protecting a free city, there are 2 broad categories of ways you can do this. There's the carrots and there's the sticks. and the legal side is largely sticks. It's extraordinarily important, as we've seen with Prospera and what's going on in the ZAs. You have to have these things in place, and you can often get recompense for, you know, violations of the agreement. But the way to, you know, that's a financial compensation in many ways. It's a mechanism to use to get people to honor their agreements. And then if they don't, it's a way to get financial compensation. The way to keep the business going and actually create the prosperity is to use those carrots. And the carrots come in many forms, but it's often jobs and it's often high quality services at a affordable price, you know, these sorts of things. My own experience is probably handouts are actually not the best carrot, but really giving opportunities for people to create their own living. You know, creating jobs is probably the single best way to align incentives. I think carrots have this risk of appearing like you're just buying us off. And I think it's a bit out of line with human nature. We want to participate and create something better, even if our circumstances are somewhat less available than maybe others. And so giving people those opportunities to really participate. I have a job now that pays me three times what it did, you know, in my previous gig. I think that's the sort of thing that gets someone to really ally with a free city. And, you know, I think certainly we've seen this. I know I've talked to Massimo in particular about his Morazan project, and this is exactly, you know, his view. And in particular, you know, being in Chiloma, where it's not the safest area, you know, he's even thinking about, of course we have security for the city, but, you know, who is the real security? It's the people living there that say, you know, this is a good and valuable thing, we want to keep this, we want to grow this, and you're not going to come in and ruin it. That's the way to get people fighting for these sorts of things by using those carrots.
Yeah, it's funny that whenever people criticize the ZAs, they never talk about Morazan, do they? I've noticed that. And I was talking to Alex the other day. He said that the last hit piece on Prospera, they also came to Morazan. They interviewed people in Morazan, and obviously it didn't make it into the hit piece because you can't pull that one apart. You know, it doesn't fit the narrative at all, you know.
I didn't know that had happened, but yeah, you absolutely can't see it. I mean, it's a higher quality space. It's a safer space. There's kids playing in the park. You have your two-bedroom apartment. It's maybe not luxurious, but it's better than every one of your other alternatives, is the truth. That doesn't fit the narrative at all.
Well, on the safety aspect, I think Chiloma is one of the most violent places around there. It's literally adjacent to it. Yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know. I've been talking so much about that these last few days because it's so disappointing is the word. It's so disappointing that this is happening. You know, I hope so much that this has a win-win for everyone, but I don't know how the government wins unless they're admitting full communism. If they are, fair enough, you win. But other than that, everyone loses in all these avenues, suing people. Like, no one wants to sue the government. And now the narrative is, oh, big, you know, outsiders, which it isn't, are suing the Honduran people, putting them. It's like, it's just all so frustrating. I don't know. Like, you've been involved in a lot of projects, and especially now, potential projects. Talk me a little bit through the process that you have to go to in sort of like, well, right from the start. How do you come up with the place, and then how do you go about negotiating what it is you're, you know, and convincing a host government to sort of, well, allow something like this to happen?
Yeah. Well, just quickly on your point about Morazan not fitting the narrative, I do think it's not just relevant, it's maybe the most relevant aspect to this whole thing because, yeah, okay, we all want free cities for the wealthy elites to go start their new technologies and start these things. I'm absolutely on board with that. But the truth is that Massimo's business model of building Morazan for the people in Chiloma and surrounding areas, that's the business that scales. There are billions of people that are moving to cities over the next decades. billions of people. Their options in these cities is often slums with terrible property rights, no opportunity for advancement. Their best bet is simply day-to-day survival. That's not acceptable to me. The reason for doing this is because we can actually provide a better place to live for just regular people that want an opportunity in life. So I do think that I want to focus on it. I think it's one of the most important things that we can point out about this.
Well, and in speaking to Massimo, myself, and Mark Luther the other day, we were saying exactly the same thing. In a way, Prospera has the challenge of attracting people to Prospera. Morazan doesn't. Nor do projects in Africa that Mark's doing. You know, if you build a city and it's better than the countryside where people are coming from, and they're coming from the countryside to the city, they're going to come. You've got guaranteed people coming. And if you provide them with a better standard of living, they're definitely coming, you know.
Absolutely. If you can build 10% better than Lagos, your city will be filled up with millions and millions of people in the next 2 decades. I can assure you that. You know, Prospera is very innovative and doing a great job, but its competition is simply steeper. You have to compete against Dubai. You have to compete against Singapore. You have to compete against Monaco. You have to compete against London, New York City, wherever it is that, you know, people are feeling at home. The people with means can move wherever they'd like. So that is very challenging.
And also, of course, there's the digital nomad aspect, which I think in the past I've put a lot more emphasis on than necessary, thinking, you know, you've got to attract digital nomads. Number one, there's not that many of them. And number two, obviously, part of the digital nomad persona is to be transient, which is they're the hardest people to kind of keep hold of. I mean, we were talking about this last night actually at dinner, wondering whether there's any data out there to show what happens to a digital nomad when they become 30 or something. Do they go home or do they go to their favorite sort of spot, or do they carry on? Because once you get a family, digital nomading is very difficult. But I don't know. It's one of the things I'm going to look up when I get back, try and find out whether there's any data on it, because it would be a useful bit of data to know, because then that would be part of your business model. It is worth attracting them, even though they're probably going to take off. Anyway, it's a sideline. Tell me about the process.
Yeah, the
and particularly, sorry to put in your role in it, because as a, like you say, you're a finance guy as much as anything. And I'd like to hear it from that perspective.
Sure. So in addition to the finance side, I'm also Fortipolis, covering all of the Americas just based on geographic dispersion. And so I do have a fair amount of experience in going to governments and having these conversations with them. I think the process, I would describe it as both top-down and bottom-up. Top-down in the sense of the truth is that some countries are better and some countries are worse for this. Very polarized societies are very difficult. I think that's one of the main lessons from Honduras, and it's absolutely zero criticism of the companies that have operated there. It's simply an acknowledgement of the fact that if one party does it, the other party doesn't like it, and it doesn't matter who did it or why. We'd like to avoid those to the extent that we can. Some semblance of stability is incredibly important. And, you know, we're also looking at other factors like access to resources, clean water, energy provision, beef and other food, you know, these sorts of things. Not because we necessarily want to be 100% self-sufficient, but we are in the business of somewhat disrupting the balance of power in the world. That's inevitably going to upset certain people. And we know we need to be, Nassim Taleb is somewhat out of favor with the Bitcoiners, and I understand that, but anti-fragile is nonetheless a good philosophy, I think, for free cities. So we do have this top-down perspective. At the same time, it's also bottom-up. The truth is this is a nascent industry. We can't simply command anyone to come take our meeting. If I was Elon Musk, I'd just fly around wherever I wanted. But the truth is that I need access to the right people. Now, fortunately, really, I think through Titus and many other people in our network, we've got a pretty substantial network. And, you know, over time, mine has grown, particularly in the Latin America region. This is extremely helpful because we are asking for a lot. This is I don't think I've ever had the experience of, a typical foreign investment would show up in a country, get a meeting with the Minister of Economy or, someone right below them. And they would talk about, here are the programs we have, here are the incentives, here's the tax situation, this is what we can offer to you. And then the business person decides, well, do I want to go here or your neighbor or the other neighbor? That doesn't work for us. We are not accepting of standard special economic zone terms. There's not been one yet that we've seen that is sufficiently extensive in terms of what we'd like to accomplish. So really, this requires alignment with the government that's in power at that time. It means that we unfortunately need to go really to the top person or the top group of people, the cabinet, the president, the prime minister. And there needs to be a philosophical alignment. I don't mean that he needs to be or she needs to be a libertarian per se, but they need to understand basics about free markets working, about they have to be interested in attracting high quality people, high performing people, contributors to society rather than people who take from it, job creators, these sorts of things. And they also have to have some chutzpah, frankly. It is not something to be done timidly. It must be something a bit like when Bukele announced Bitcoin. He did it with a lot of ambition, a lot of gravitas, and he's owned it and he's benefited from it. I think there's a lot to benefit from, but it can't be something that, oh, we're dipping our toe in the water. No, if we're going to do it, we're going to do it right. And we need to, Tipolis needs to put the investment in, and we need the government's support to say, we like this, we want to do this, we're behind it, because there will be negative views and we want that support.
Interestingly, what you're saying would allude to the fact that Argentina would be a good place to cite a free city these days, but I've heard that that's not necessarily the case with Milei. Can you comment on anything to do with that?
There's a little bit I can say publicly. I think in many ways Argentina is a great place. It's actually quite primed for something like this in many ways. Of course, Milei being there and someone who is generally predisposed to our ideas, it's also a place that is, it has had a lot of capital in the past. You can see when you go there, it does have the sort of framework of an old European place with lots of investments and a lot of productivity, and things are relatively nice. You can also see that it's been dilapidated over the last decades. So, from my perspective, and particularly from the finance side, I see, okay, this is a country that's attracted capital. They've invested capital, relatively properly. They've created great things. At the same time, they haven't kept up with it. This is a perfect opportunity for a free city. That said, you also get in this little bit of a challenge where, someone like Milei is really focused right now on reforming the entire country. And one of our value propositions really as a free city is that we understand that electoral politics is very difficult. It is very difficult to reform the entire country. And maybe, Milei is already having some of these challenges, but his goal remains for now focused on making the whole country of Argentina better. And that seems to make perfect sense to me. I think potentially later down the line when he realizes, okay, some of my reforms haven't quite come to be, and also the next government may repeal or challenge some of these things, they may fall away and a free city may have been a better way. But, who knows? I'm definitely supportive of him.
Has he spoken about economic zones at all? Because that's a great way to try things out before you roll them out into the rest of the country.
I don't know a ton about what he's spoken about that particular topic publicly. I know he is aware of them. I know he is supportive of them in sort of their global industry perspective. I don't know if he's spoken about them in the context of Argentina.
Someone else you mentioned just now, very briefly, was Elon Musk, who's obviously a very interesting character at the moment. Someone who's potentially also at the forefront of new frontier places. I mean, we're talking Mars and space and stuff. Is everyone trying to get hold of him? Is that just a kind of what the lay person would think? But would he be a good person to sort of get on board with all this stuff?
Yes and no. I wouldn't say no to having a meeting with Musk. That said, I don't spend any time, not even a second, trying to think about how do I get in front of him and he is the key to success. I don't think that's right. I think there are other avenues. I'm sure that there are people in our space that know him. I believe he is aware of our space, generally speaking. I believe he's an ally and moving more towards the worldview of being supportive and helping us. But I think there are many other avenues to success as well. And, you know, Musk, for all his great successes, one concern that I would have is he likes to have control of his companies, and, you know, for good reason, he's very successful. That I'm not so sure that I believe he understands liberalism or libertarianism well enough that I'd really want him in control of the development of a free city personally. But of course, this is subject to change as time goes by. I do understand he's reading and learning a lot about this. And
Am I right in thinking he did actually talk about a plan for a kind of city, probably a Tesla city, I would imagine, in the same vein as the Toyota city in Japan? Is that right?
Yeah, I think it was in Texas, and it's I think he's got one for SpaceX, maybe also for Tesla. The idea is mostly for his workers to really live there and be close and on site at all times. We'll see. I think, you know, how that goes could be interesting. I don't know that the United States, even with Musk, is some place that's available for free cities. It's maybe the one entity in the world more powerful than Musk, really. But I do wonder if that experience with trying to set up a new city will lead him to realize some of the challenges that he has because of bureaucratic incentives, even in Texas. These create challenges to creating a new city, and maybe in fact it is a way to push him more towards our view of the world.
Whatever happened to Trump's cities? Was it frontier cities or something? I can't remember what he called them.
Freedom cities.
Freedom cities. Yeah. What happened to those? Was that during his term, or was that during? I can't remember when it happened.
I don't remember when he first announced it. At least 2 or 3 years ago, maybe even 4 or 5. I also know that it's come back in the last 6 months, maybe roughly. It's definitely something he's talking about again, but it's like many of Trump's proposals. He's, you know, talked about abolishing the income tax. Kudos, please do, but I'm not holding my breath. So
what about this idea that I met a few people here, new folks that we haven't met before at the conference, who are essentially real estate developers who've started acknowledging that, hey, you know, people are looking for freedom, and maybe that's an important part of this real estate development plan. It's not just about siting a new city. It's about potentially creating something that's a little bit more secure, a little bit more off-grid, maybe a little bit more, you know, free, even talking about maybe, you know, making it into some kind of a zone. What's your opinion on the best strategy to kind of achieving your goal? Do you think it's best to sort of go straight in, straight to the top and say, look, this is what we want to do? Or what about, or the incremental way, which might be to first create a city, and then once you've got that leverage, you say, well, look, give us a bit of autonomy and I can probably promise you this much more in tax revenue or this much more, whatever. What's your opinion?
I'm supportive of both. I think absolutely both are necessary. There are benefits and drawbacks to both. If you go in at the top and you say, look, I'm not investing a dollar until I get what I want, you're going to get denied more often than success. But you're also very efficient with your use of funds and waiting, you know, until finally you get the right framework, and then you can really deploy capital. On the other hand, bottom up, certainly you're getting good, relations, and you're proving yourself. You're showing a little bit of something, proof of work in some sense, to a government. You know, that said, you're also you know, the government that you're then negotiating with also has leverage on you and say, well, you've invested X billions in building this new city and you've already been successful. Why do you need more? I think it's a bit challenging. That said, you know, I think different regions of the world respond slightly differently to these sorts of questions. I think in some of them, it's actually quite good to have both of these conversations going on. And I think it's really important for free city groups to have relationships with real estate developers, because it is a bit of a, you know, one of the challenges we get from Tipla's side is, okay, it looks very professional. It looks like you've got some investor support. This all seems to make sense, but point to me on the map where you've built a city before. And until we've built a city, there's no city to point to. That said, you can sort of rely on your network of, okay, well, we work with X, Y, and Z, and they're a very serious company that's developed towns, or they've developed this or that, totaling X billions. And that sort of gives comfort to, okay, these guys are, there's always execution risk, but these guys are serious enough that they have the money and they've actually built something before. There's a reasonable chance this actually does happen.
Who has actually built a city before?
Well, I mean, I think there's a number of Middle Eastern development companies, Amar and these sorts of groups have built, you know, quasi cities. There's a group out of New York City that built a city in South Korea called Songdo. The development company is Gale International, and they had a joint venture partnership with a construction company, state-owned construction company from South Korea. That would be another big one. There's been a few in the United States as well that you could probably call city-sized developments. It's a small group, but nonetheless, it has been done, and I think it can be done again. There's also been some in India, by the way.
So in your negotiations, are you quite flexible on the size? I mean, how does it work? I've got absolutely no idea what goes through your mind when you're approaching someone. Are you thinking about, you know, I mean, how much do you take into the first meeting? You know, how can you know what it is you want to create and how many people want to live there? And what are their town squares, you know, like play parks? I don't know. You know, sure. That's a lot of production to do, pre-production to do for a meeting. It's not like you just do a bit of research. You've really got to, you know, put years and years and years of time into it, right?
Yes, and exactly what you're saying is part of the reason why this is such a difficult sell. It's very abstract. It's unfortunately a bit of trust us. We are reasonably smart people. We know how to think about this, and where we don't, we have access to people that can. So it does make it difficult. I mean, going into a meeting, we don't know the specifics of exactly what's to be built, the exact size. In fact, we are flexible on some of those things in terms of what does a host nation want. You could imagine in a place where, you know, the population might be, call it 1 to 5 million, that they wouldn't necessarily be so eager to create a new city of, call it 10 million, a mega city of 10 million. This would be very, very weird dynamics in that host nation. It doesn't mean, you know, things like that can't evolve over time, but it's, you know, getting the green light with that sort of suggestion is very difficult. So I would say we're very flexible in many regards. Where we're not flexible is we really do want a significant amount of autonomy. We spend the first meeting or so explaining who we are, you know, how we got to this sort of space, trying to convince them that we're a serious group, and then laying out the principles, the key enablers, as we like to call them, that allow for the creation of Tipolis's model, which is the international city. That's really what the first conversation is, because it's not really worth having more conversations. If you say, I just can't do this right now, that's totally okay. In fact, I'm quite fond of the answer no. I would like, you know, a no is not as good as a yes, but at least I can then move on to other things. And so we do spend a fair amount of upfront time on that question first.
So when they say you get past the first meeting, have you got an international cities pitch deck? Is that how it works at that level? Is it you just, you know, some slides of talk? This is my quant, you know, whatever, that kind of a thing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we have a very general pitch book that's, you know, it's not just reused every time. It's slightly tailored, but it's pretty standardized for that first meeting. After that, things get a heck of a lot more serious, which is why we are asking for that first meeting of let's talk about these enablers and whether or not they're possible. I'm not asking for a commitment, just is this on the table? And if it is, then we can sort of judge at Tipalus how much resources we'd like to allocate towards this. Because as you mentioned, it is very difficult. It is very time consuming. We have to do a heck of a lot of research on a number of different things. Sometimes even, you know, search out land plots and try to suggest a few just to sort of inspire what it is that we're thinking, even at that stage.
So let's talk about autonomy then. And you said quite specifically then, it's a very important aspect. I should imagine that is a very constricting aspect as well. If any other person was going in trying to create a real estate project, just by mentioning the word autonomy, you have limited your success rate to probably 5%. I don't know, whatever. Talk about autonomy. What kind of autonomy do you need? Like, what's your base level of autonomy at International Cities, for example?
Sure. There are a number of different aspects to autonomy. Some of the most important are, you know, regulatory autonomy. Can we create the rules and regulations under which the city operates? We think that's extremely important, and you can see the examples in Prosper of how they've used that autonomy that they have to attract, you know, biotech and other sorts of innovative industries. We think that's quite important. Having our own financial autonomy in terms of we can choose which currency in which to do business or to denominate contracts. We can choose, you know, if and what people have to pay taxes or fees or, you know, these sorts of things in the city. What is legal tender? I mean, we don't exactly have legal tender typically, but we want at least, you know, the ability for people to conduct in any currency they'd like. I think some other ones that are really quite tricky are immigration, which has a number of different aspects to it. Typically, you know, immigration, if you're already in the host nation coming into the international city, that's usually an okay term for host nations. But we'd also like, you know, direct access into the free city through an airport or a seaport or something like this. That's a little bit challenging. We'd like to even have our own personnel, you know, manning this sort of station. Now that's very, very difficult there. Sometimes we get into compromises. It will be a host nation's immigration officials, but the free city will pay for it in order to make sure that the user experience is, you know, they're quick and efficient. It's a person that's working there with a smile on their face, these sorts of things to try to make it, you know, very friendly, since we are in fact in the business of competing for people with means and other choices to move to our city.
You just alluded to something which is at the base of the problems that all free cities had, is that you're competing for your customers. And governments don't like that. I think that's pretty universally, it's not overtly said, but in this day and age, it's very observable that governmental response to competition is actually just to be the mafia and say and be the bigger bully, and in nefarious ways. We're seeing lots of taxes, exit taxes, wealth taxes, you know, being talked about all around the world now as a response to the fact that places like Dubai are basically being very competitive. So, you know, and this is one of the things I detest most about the current state of politics, is that the knee-jerk reaction to competition is not to be better. It's to bloody just, you know, make a law or a regulation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the way I view this is that it's a cartel of smaller monopolies on the use of force. And what's interesting is, I think you're exactly right. The Dubais of the world have been very, very successful. And there's a bit of international pressure to say, hey guys, you're doing a little bit too well. I think we need to dial some of this back. You might want to implement, you know, whatever tax or these sorts of things.
And that has, that's actually happened in the Emirates now.
Absolutely.
That's the VAT that you pay. It wasn't their decision, right? It was the pressure.
In my view, that's right. On the other hand, you know, Dubai didn't want to do that. They were sort of hamstrung into it. And I think almost every other country, particularly developing countries, so we might not be talking about the United States, probably we're not talking about Germany and France, but, you know, we are talking about much of Latin America, much of Southeast Asia. These countries actually would like to give tax benefits and these sorts of things to compete. That is, in fact, that's one, another reason why zones are extremely effective. It's, we can't just do this at a nationwide level because there's international pressure to say you can't go no tax, but we can do a little zone here that allows this and this. So I think that actually zones are sort of a way to increase that competition, and host nations understand that and are using that weapon. And what I would just mention finally on why a free city is even better than the example of Dubai is Dubai did get hamstrung by this. And then they implemented the VAT and potentially even a corporate income tax. A free city has a contract with its host nation that says, as of this date, the only host nation laws that apply are A, B, and C. And that's it. It's a guarantee of that stability. So in the future, when the IMF or the United States or whoever the boogeyman is shows up and they say, We need you to implement this higher tax, then the best that the host nation can do, at least on paper, and again, we're back to the carrots and sticks, is fine, we can implement this tax, but it can't be on this group because we've already given them 50 or 100 or whatever it is years of this guarantee.
This just made me think about another potential drawback to the free city model. When you're talking about a free zone or an economic zone, you're talking about businesses getting preferential treatment. If you were to grant that to individuals, there's the possibility that there might be a bit more animosity between people. People, I think it's harder for people to get pissed off with Apple, who are now getting a preferential tax treatment, because actually they're providing me with a product. But when it's a neighbor and they're over there and they're paying 4% and you're over here paying 20%. Is that something that you've ever thought about before?
Sure. I think jealousy is unfortunately part of human nature, and this very well could happen. But the idea would be we create enough opportunity here that if you're really that jealous of it, why don't you come to the free city too and not pay that? There are challenges with that from a selling this to host nation perspective, because they often want things like tax stability guarantees. You know, if we give us opportunity and then every one of our businesses that's in our national registry or every one of our taxpayers that's in our national registry then moves to the free city, you know, probably the revenues go down, at least in the short run, you know, as businesses and new sort of innovations are ramping up. So that is a challenge, and we'll have to work through that. But you know, the answer is never, okay, my neighbor's got a better solution. I want to tear him down. I understand people do this, but to me, this is a bad argument.
I think governments do that.
I don't disagree with you.
What's your favorite location that you see around the world that kind of incorporates as many of these kind of successful traits as possible?
Well, I think each location has its benefits and drawbacks. Without naming specific countries, I can tell you places that have high, you know, cattle per capita, places with a bit of extra space, places with significant hydropower, you know, places that have a history of stability in terms of regional war and sort of what is predicted for international sort of major scale United States, Soviet Union, or United States, Russia type war scenarios. You know, those are all quite important. I also think it's quite important to think about climate. You know, sometimes right in the equator, it's simply too hot for most people. There are ways to make it cooler, but it's still quite sticky and hot in many cases. You know, some people might like that. I think the majority want a bit of a more temperate climate. So I think, I mean, all of these things are very important. And I do think it's very true that the truth is that it's different strokes for different folks. People want different things, and we need to provide a variety.
What about actually existing places? You know, the Singapores, the Prosperas, the United States, you know, where do you see the ideals that you possess working the best in real life at the moment?
I do think the United States is still quite good on this front. I think Dubai is also quite good on this front. Singapore and Monaco to some degree, although, you know, Monaco is a bit more maybe sleepy than not quite as dynamic maybe. And Singapore is a bit, you know, I have a bit of this theory about why the United States has there are many reasons why the United States has become the most productive country in the history of the world. But one of the key ones is I think it blends two extremely important aspects to productivity. On the one hand, you have sort of strict adherence to rule following. I show up for meetings on time. If I said I would get this done, I will do it. Attention to detail. You know, my Excel file will be completely up to date, saved and stored in the right place, and so on and so forth. On the other hand, you have the creative types, slightly less attention to detail, but the dreamers, the aspirers, maybe we shouldn't even try to tinker and do this a little bit better. Maybe we should just radically rethink how this question is even thought about. And I think both of those are extremely important. I, you know, just to, of course, paint with way too broad of a brush, but I think, you know, Germans, for example, and Singaporeans are slightly more on the attention to detail, you know, strict, and maybe slightly less dynamic. They're better at engineering and these sorts of things and a little less good at innovation. I think there are many other places of the world, you know, Latin America, much of the United States, that's a bit more spontaneous and dynamic. And I think actually the marriage of those two is the reason the United States has been successful. You have to have the dreamers, the aspirers that have these new ideas, and you also have to have the people that are able to implement, show up on time, execute these sorts of things to make it work. And so I think for that reason, the United States has really fit this mold over time. I'm concerned about its future, but I'm not so sure that where I'm sitting right now, I can point to anywhere and say, I'd rather be there. It's possible Dubai. I mean, it's hard for me to say Dubai. I'm from America, and it's also a drastically different time zone. I could imagine it's easier for a European to potentially say that. So that's kind of how I would see it.
That, loosely speaking, your dreamers and conservers, are we loosely speaking talking about political slants there as well? Are they Republicans, the conservers on one side, and the dreamers are the sort of Democrats?
Probably in practice, it falls a bit like that. I don't particularly mean it in that way. I think the, you know, much of a Latin America also has sort of more spice to it, as I would call it. But it's, you know, many of them are very staunchly conservative socially. So I don't think it necessarily falls perfectly neatly on those lines. And you know, I also think maybe this was more the case formerly. Nowadays, I'm not so sure I see, you know, hardly any redeeming qualities in the Democratic Party, frankly. The Republican Party, okay. So I think it's more about the marriage of Silicon Valley with New York, I would say, than about politics. And in both of those places are relatively, you know, Democratic, actually. But I think it's the marriage of the two. It's the finance, the executors, and the...
How do you find the different areas of the spectrum in the Free Cities ecosystem? You know, you've got the... And these are my categorizations, but broadly speaking, you've got the pre-private cities people at one end and the kind of network state people at the other. Is that... That's my categorization, but it's more like... Online, and the way it manifests is build a real city and invite people to come and... create an online community and then try and get them to move to a city, you know?
Yeah, I think that's probably about right. I'm not so sure it shapes onto what I was just describing, unless I'd have to think about it a bit more. But I think you're right, and that is the dichotomy in the space. I think, again, it's both of these things are valuable. In some sense, we're back to the question of top-down or bottom-up. You know, network states are a bit more bottom up of let's get the community and we can use that to leverage, just like a real estate developer can say, I built a city, give me more autonomy. A network state can say, I built a community, give me more autonomy. And I think actually you marry them together.
How much of that aspect, the community first aspect, does Tipolis think about?
Well, arguably not enough. That said, it's very difficult to think about this question. You know, I think about one of the groups I see that it is very good at this community formation is Praxis. But what's made it relatively easy for them to focus on this is that they defined their goal as building a Silicon Valley or similar type place in the Mediterranean. That's a pretty defined group of people and a pretty defined region of the world in which to execute this. Tipolis, on the other hand, our goal is to build the freest place on earth, places for opportunity and choice to create. That's a much broader goal, and how it manifests in any individual location will be very, very different. We're currently looking at some options in Southeast Asia and Latin America. These are radically different places, and it will manifest very differently. The common theme is that it's people that want to create. It's people that want to have the ability to live with their family and sort of tune out politics. It's people that want to have more economic opportunity and not have as much in the way of government burdens. But beyond that, very little, right? These are I suspect as well that where the movers come for each one of these cities, should they move forward, will be very different. It will be mostly people from Asia living in the Asian project. It will be mostly people from North America, Central America, South America living in the Americas project.
Arguably as well, Praxis, the barrier to entry for Praxis is very low. It's pretty much fill in an online form to say, I want to live there. That's about it, isn't there? I haven't really gone deep into it yet, but.
Well, I perhaps it is that low, at least for the baseline level, but still it's something. And what they've done is created this image and appearance in which people identify with and therefore are willing to go and fill out your 2-minute form to do that. And I do know they have this steel visa thing, which I'm not an expert in, but it appears to be at least some, at least you have to pay something for it, which is, always difficult to get people to part with money. So,
do you think it'd be beneficial to, in your pitches, to come in saying we've got a potential 5,000 people interested, or is the cost benefit not there? Is it going to cost too much to sort of get that?
It would be extremely valuable. I would love to have that. The problem is it's a different group of people for each project, and so we start having conversations, we start dreaming up, okay, what is the economic development platform for this sort of project, this sort of geolocation, all those sorts of things. I'd love to have it. In some places it's very obvious, so you can see migration trends and various geopolitical things that are happening and therefore pick up on this is who would move. In other cases, frankly, we're sitting there saying, I understand why your country's had some challenges growing economically. It's not so obvious to me, how you attract people here. So I think it depends, but absolutely, if I could go in anytime, the more people I can have in my potential mover list, the more power I have. Yeah.
I don't know whether there's an unholy alliance to be had there. Do you think? Like, say, between the kind of Praxis types and the kind of free private cities types. I mean, maybe there's not a lot of overlap. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it would seem obvious that those two groups should work together. But whether or not they're even the same people, it's very hard to say. I mean, I went to like a pop-up city, one of those projects, and there is a distinct cultural difference between these two sides as well,
There is definitely a distinct difference. I think one of the great aspects so far is that there is one theme that seems to be running through both, and that is, generally speaking, This is all a voluntary sort of thing. And to me, that's extremely crucial and arguably the only thing that really matters at this phase. And so as long as that is there, I think, sure, it's absolutely an option for, you know, a sort of free private city physical development group to partner with a network state type group. I think the question then becomes, you know, who exactly and whose brand and whose reputation do you want to some way tie yourself to? And, you know, so in theory, I'm in agreement with you. In practice, it's not, you know, just the easiest thing to just say, of course, we should do this. There are other factors behind the scenes.
And the demographic, of course. I should imagine there's quite a high proportion of digital nomads in the network state ecosystem.
Right.
Which, as we've discussed earlier, aren't actually a very good business model, as far as I can tell.
Right.
I mean, they are a tough business model. It's obviously crackable, but you have to work a lot harder than if you were to provide something more traditional and more family orientated, which is, I think it's fair to say, that's Tiplis's slant, right?
100%. I have no problem with the digital nomads. I think in many ways they're quite helpful for creating buzz about a city, but the money to be made, I don't think, is in digital nomads. I think, like you said, it's families, it's just normal people that want to have a bit more relaxed lifestyle, maybe less up in arms. That's in fact, you know, one of the, you know, Tiplis is not necessarily in the business of just building Ciudad Morazan's. Potentially that those could happen, but it's, I do like the philosophy there where it's, we're not trying to be the most, you know, build the tallest skyscraper and have, you know, flying cars and all this sorts of Jetsons type stuff. What we would like to do is just go back to normal ways for people to live together, normal forms of architecture, making things walkable and presentable and easy for the human scale, as we like to say. And that's going to attract, you know, young families with a few children, and this makes life very pleasant for people. And I think that's where the business model really is.
Do you have a particular methodology of city building, which, you know, loosely speaking, you've got the idea that you come in, you plan a city, and then you build it? Or the other model might be you come in, you create a central square, you site a hospital, maybe you site a school, I don't know what, and then you let the kind of market produce the city. What's the Tiplis way?
We have a very nuanced way of thinking about this. And of course, we think it's right. But, you know, full disclosure, we haven't built a city yet. So let's see how this goes. We are the view of something called market urbanism. And, you know, the way this starts is we have something we call a master pattern, not a master plan. I mean, in fact, it becomes a master plan because governments need this in order to move forward with a project. But it's a master pattern, meaning there's flexibility built into it. There is a method and a logic to the overall structure, but the nuances within it can and do change. They can be slightly different, which makes the city very interesting. And so starting with that master pattern, we'll pick one little seed within the whole master pattern and develop that. We have to, at some point, just put something in the ground and it is what it is, and then, you know, see how people respond to it. But that is the way to do it. It's very iterative. It's very Hayekian in some sense. The challenge with this is that, you know, I think this is the right way to build a city. It's how many of the European cities became very beautiful. The challenge is that those happened over centuries. We need to fast track this. And that is very difficult. I think, you know, one thing that you have to do is you have to have an architect. And I think we have a very great one who's very understanding of human nature, very understanding of markets and how they work and feedback and these sorts of things. And so he's very, very attuned to, okay, well, if we build this, then this is the sort of way it might impact the human experience in this situation. You can try to plan that as best as you can. I think he's very great at it, but the truth is that you simply can't plan these sorts of things. That is the humility that it takes. So that's sort of how we'll think about this question. We will do our best. It's going to be imperfect, as all human things are. But I think it's start small, scale up just gradually, and, you know, take the feedback as best as you can to try to create something that's, as always, you know, we learned yesterday from Per Bylund, I think this idea of entrepreneurs as value creators, you are trying to create value in the life of every resident every day. Why is it that they want to move there? It's because they like all of the things that they experience every day.
That term master pattern, I've never heard that before. That's a really good, very descriptive term. Was that someone at Tibblers that came up with that?
I think Marthinus, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a phenomenally good way of explaining what he's talking about. Does that mean there's a time scale on these things from start to finish? Do you say like 10 years, 5 years, I don't know, and then build the center, I don't know, build the bit. You've got to build something, like you say, you've got to work fast at the beginning, but then you leave it up to the market to dictate the pattern. Mm-hmm. But what kind of time scale is it then?
Yeah, it's, we're probably talking 20 plus years. A city is never complete is the truth, but we're probably talking about 20 plus years for the entirety of what we would like to build, in some sense, in a pre-planned way. That said, I think, you know, it takes just a couple of years to build the first sort of kernel and see how these sorts of things go. As you're getting more and more people, you can expand. The other way that we like to allow the market to work in terms of expansion is we want pretty strong control of the master pattern. What we don't want strong control over is the actual development of every piece of that master pattern. We would like to set out general framework, general guidelines, that is the pattern, and have other developers, other architects coming in. They're reading off our song sheet. They know, they understand what the vision that we're going for, but they interpret it in their own unique way. I think this allows market prices to play some level of role in this, because you get people that are coming in and saying, I will pay, you know, X for the land because I have this great thing. You're allowing the market to work. I also think it allows for variety. You know, I'm definitely not an architect. I'm not very artistic at all, but I do think one of the keys to making a beautiful city is that there's some level of consistency to the whole thing. And yet it's not boring. It's not the same thing again and again. It's not copy paste like American suburbia or like, former Eastern Bloc, countries. It's a little bit of both. You get that like here in Prague. And I think trying to replicate that, the best way to do it is set out simple rules and patterns in which you have to follow, and then letting people interpret that as they will.
And those patterns would include the architectural style, for example, mm-hmm. which from what I understand from talking to Martinus is very much traditional period type design. Is that right?
Yeah. Things that look beautiful. They look like they took a lot of human work and skill to build, not just concrete blocks that were put up for, hyper efficient in the sense of we can build as many as possible in the next, 1 year, but rather things that are intricate and very valuable to the human experience, but without, but perhaps, people underestimate or undervalue just how important this is to them. But that's why they go to old cities in Europe for vacations. And they say, oh my goodness, like, this is just amazing to be able to take a walk in the park and see, some of these old cathedrals and these sorts of things. That's what we'd like to create.
Sometimes that can be a bit of a pitfall. My wife, we live in a lovely old house, but my wife hates it when they build period houses, from scratch. Mm-hmm. There's a couple, I love it actually. There's a, where were we the other day? We were driving somewhere down in the southwest of England, and someone had built an expansive development of Georgian homes. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. I thought it looked great. But her and I said, no, but I know that this is a facade. This isn't real. I disagree with that. I think, especially if you are using real stone, I think it makes a difference if you're casting molds in concrete and putting them on there. But if you're a stonemason is creating things out of stone, mm-hmm. I don't think it matters which period it comes from. And there's nothing wrong with mimicking past periods either.
No, I not just nothing wrong with it. I think it is a good and righteous thing to do, is to take the successes. I mean, in its truest sense, that I am a conservative in many ways, in the sense of I think that we should look at the past and more or less accept that there's a reason we're all still here. There's a reason things generally work. Therefore, being conservative is probably, you know, an extremely beneficial thing. Now, of course, you don't just take anything. You know, you can always improve and tinker. Absolutely. I'm not a conservative in that sense. But I do think it's important to take from the past the things that work. And probably my view is, at least, the assumption that what was done in the past is right and you are not better at making decisions than the past is probably the, you know, default option.
One of the things I think is possibly true about the reason why we see such low quality buildings currently, especially modernist functional buildings, is the cost. And I would imagine that, you know, paying a stonemason to carve facades on the front of a building is quite inefficient compared to creating a modernist box out of steel and whatever. Arguably, though, the reason that's so expensive is because of the financial system, the monetary system that we live under. And I think that might be a nice little segue into having a quick Bitcoin conversation. Sure. Since you've written a book about Bitcoin. But I mean, first of all, would you agree with that theory?
I would agree with that theory, and I would take it further and suggest that this is particularly manifest in the United States, but perhaps elsewhere as well. The financial system, the debasement of currency, and the tax and related regulatory incentives have created a system of incentivizing developers to leverage, meaning take on debt, to develop everything. The only way to get a return is to leverage everything up to its eyeballs, and you get the tax deductions for interest on that debt. That means that if you are a financier of real estate development, you want to get your return. You also know that you have to lever it up, which makes everything very, very risky. And so what is the thing that you decide to do? You try to de-risk it in every way possible. Well, the way you de-risk it is copy and paste. We've already learned that the single family home that's built like this will be bought by, you know, this amount of people over this amount of time. And so we are not going to innovate in any way, shape, or form. We're simply going to copy and paste. I think this creates a very strong incentive to just get more boring neighborhoods, more boring buildings, that sort of thing.
And cheaper materials as well?
Probably cheaper materials. I do think that that's absolutely cutting corners, wherever you can. It's, you know, it's a sort of form of shrinkflation. If I can make the wood boards or whatever else slightly, you know, more efficiently in one perspective, or slightly worse and from another perspective, I think that's absolutely going to play a role.
Does that mean in a typical international city, you will pay the same price for a property that's far superior than in the outside world? Or do you pay more for a property?
We'll find out. I don't know the answer to that, because on the one hand, what will happen in a free city is that you can build a lot more cost effective, a lot faster, and time is frankly one of the most expensive things in development. On the other hand, what you're paying for is not simply the physical land and building. You're paying for the protection of that, both the sort of, you know, security in terms of, policemen and these sorts of things, but also the legal security. I mean, there's a reason why a land and a home in Honduras, even if it's very nice and high quality, is not as expensive as, you know, the same thing in New York City, for example.
Well, Massimo himself has discovered that he can build cheaper homes inside the ZA,
yep,
of better quality than the outside. So arguably, I mean, it would be phenomenal. I would love to see a move back to, you know, low time preference houses again. I mean, totally. You know, our house is, what, almost 500 years old in parts, and a lot of it hasn't changed in that time at all. And, you know, that it's such an inspiring way to build, to think in those terms. And it's literally a symptom of the sort of debt, the indebted financial system, that you think short term. Absolutely. You have to think short term. You can't predict long term because everything you do is like losing value over time.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's have a Bitcoin conversation then. What was your book called? Bitcoin and Free Cities, right?
Yep. Strategies for Liberty.
Strategies for Liberty. So come on then, Bitcoin and Free Cities.
Yeah, the book is really meant to be a primer on two topics. One on Bitcoin. I'm certainly not going into the detail. If you've read, you know, the Bitcoin Standard and some of these other books, I'm not going to tell you anything you don't already know. However, it might be slightly shorter and slightly more accessible to newcomers. I've also done the same thing then for really simplifying Titus's book, Free Private Cities, trying to give just the basics of, you know, what these two things are. In truth, they're to me the really only effective strategies for liberty that we have in our repertoire. I'm not really a fan of electoral systems. And so I really wanted to focus on these two things as our strategies for liberty. So I cover them both separately and then also talk a little bit about the interaction between the two. You know, there's obvious things like the funding of free cities and free private cities through Bitcoiners. That's pretty obvious. But even things like, you know, how do you make yourself the least, you know, less of a target internationally? Or how do you make yourself anti-fragile? And one, of course, is using Bitcoin payments. So when a free city does something and they say, we're not going to go along with what the rest of the world does, and they get cut off from the SWIFT banking system, well, then you can use Bitcoin, that sort of thing. Then you get these options of, okay, the host nation wants to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. They want to expropriate all the property. Well, of course, they can take all of the physical property there. They can roll the tanks in, and probably we can't fight back. But if we're doing things on a Bitcoin standard, well, then we all flee. You might get what's there, but you're getting nothing in the future. There's no gold in the vaults to seize. There's no bank accounts to freeze. We're just going to take our capital and go elsewhere. I think that, you know, if you use Bitcoin and you have 2 to 3, 5, 10, whatever it is, free cities, where there's some level of mobility between the two, I think there's a lot of overlap between these two concepts and how you make the whole system more anti-fragile. And of course, the free cities themselves provide, you know, a space for Bitcoiners, a space for Bitcoin companies to create, and a space to sort of, you know, bring new technologies on top of Bitcoin, like layers, layer twos and these sorts of things into existence.
I would posit they're an essential partnership. In fact, I had a really interesting conversation a few episodes ago about this exact thing and how Bitcoin as a technology has, in Ben, the guy I interviewed, in his words, it was that Bitcoin has exited the arena of violence. You can't expropriate Bitcoin with violence. I mean, it's very difficult, though, put it that way. But it didn't take us with it. And this is the one question that I think I've got to the bottom of it now. And the answer is there's no way to deal with it when it comes down to it, except to flee. But maybe you've got another angle on it. How do we physically leave the arena of violence, as it were? I mean, free cities are a version of freedom in the real world. It's never going to be, you're never going to be able to protect it from everything.
Unfortunately, I think that's right. I don't at all want to be accused of being utopian. That's not the purpose of this. My whole role in this space is, you know, what is the reality and how do we actually manifest this in the real world? I think when we're talking about human affairs, there's simply no way to perfect this. The point of these two ideas or concepts working together is that they work with each other. And working with each other, they actually reduce the benefits of violence mutually. Of course, Bitcoin does this because, you know, if I have a multi-sig and it's in different jurisdictions and someone bashes me over the head or pulls my fingernails out, I cannot potentially, if I set it up the right way, I cannot give you the information. You'd have to get on a plane and, you know, this is a very, very difficult thing to pull off. At the same time, you know, I then can have a free city where in the real world, you know, this sort of thing, you can sue the operator if he doesn't provide you basic protection from petty criminals. So I think basically between the two, we can more or less solve the incentives for violence on a sort of petty scale, on a petty criminal scale. On a geopolitical scale, I don't know that we can necessarily solve that. I think there are, I mean, in a world with nuclear weapons, I'm not sure what can be done. You know, even if you're in a free city as in the Pitcairn Islands, for example, as far away from anything as possible, if the United States and Russia go to nuclear war, probably you're still going to die. I mean, the truth is that there's not enough being produced elsewhere to import it. You know, you're going to have all this acid rain and these sorts of things destroying all kinds of food everywhere. It's just a bad scenario. So I know, you know, I don't want to be utopian. I'm not sure that this is my one critique of the Bitcoin solves everything sort of worldview is it solves a heck of a lot, but you still have to produce real goods and services. You still have to live in this, meat world.
What's your attitude on the general fight back or flee strategy in the case of, I'm not talking nuclear wars here, I'm just talking a bit like what's happening with Prosper, you know, or just freedom in general. Mm-hmm. Because traditionally, I suppose the way to realize freedom was to find a frontier. We know that frontiers very few and far between now. So, you know, there's more of an incentive, I suppose, to, I don't know whether fight's the right word. I think in this movement, we're very much about creating a parallel system and, sure, and opting in. But you know what I mean? Is it best to look for the new frontier, or is it better to try and change it from within, let's say?
Well, I'm in this space because I think creating something new and alternative is probably better. That said, you know, maybe a better term would be stand your ground. And I think that's also a very viable strategy. I think, frankly, if you don't stand your ground, you will always be fleeing. You will never have anything. Prospera got a commitment from the government of Honduras to have this arrangement for the next, I think, 45 years at this point. The government is reneging on its deal. We're not fighting back. We're standing our ground. This is what was given, and you are the one that is encroaching on it. So I think that this is also important. You know, I think one of the things that must be considered, though, in the stand your ground or fight back sort of scenario is likelihood of success. I mean, you don't want to die on any hill. So in that sense, you know, I think what Prosper is doing is excellent. They're, it seems to me, quite likely to win this arbitration suit in Washington, D.C. I don't know exactly by how much or when and how fast and all that, but it seems to me their standing's pretty darn good. On the other hand, you could argue voting in the United States, for example, is a form of standing your ground. Let's just vote for the better guys and vote the bad guys out. Potentially, this worked at times. I'm not at all convinced this is helpful now. I know my vote has never counted, or meant anything for any of the elections I've ever voted in. It's pretty clear that, you know, if you're in 42 of the states within the union, it's completely irrelevant. They're going to go for who they're going to go for. It means only 8 states matter. Even those 8 states are solved typically by hundreds of thousands of votes. And even if you were the marginal vote for a marginally better candidate, they're still co-opted as soon as they get in power. We saw Donald Trump brought in John Bolton. Like, this is a complete lunacy to expect change at the federal level in the United States, to me, that I'm not so sure I'd fight back there. But I think there are ways to stand your ground more locally, you know, of course, the way Prosper did, but also even locally in the United States, for example, you know, your local, you know, school council, these sorts of things, to make sure your children aren't being taught things that is pretty inconsistent with human nature and human history.
Amen to that. But just before we go, can you give me a 50 to 100 year prediction, according to what you know now, for the future of, well, what we're talking about here? Everything, freedom, free cities.
Well, I think in 50 to 100 years, Bitcoin will be as likely as anything else to be the currency that the majority of people use. I don't necessarily mean that it's 50% or more likely, but just that of all the possibilities out there, that it is at least as likely. Of course, it's becoming more valuable. I don't think there's any question about that. I think free cities are existing now probably in 50 years, probably in 25 countries. There's probably millions, tens of millions of people, maybe hundreds of millions of people in them, not billions. I don't believe it's billions. I think that we have a very dichotomous world of the people living in the old world under traditional systems and those that chose a different path living the way we want to. That's the optimistic side of me. So I do hope for that. I do think that's reasonably plausible. However, the pessimist side of me thinks that in the next 50 to 100 years, it's rather more likely than not there's nuclear war.
Wow. I can't end on that. I'm gonna ask you something about the positive scenario there. In this scenario, where you have still have a very dichotomous society, so the people who the traditional way of living and the new way of living, are these happening within the same country? Or is the dichotomy happening within the same country, or are the free cities basically all pervasive in that country, which is kind of what we saw in Dubai, right?
Yeah. I think it's the latter. I think it's the countries that decide to move forward with this. Once you let this sort of thing in, it's hard to keep a control on the rest of the population, even if they aren't technically within a free city, like we talked about in the Monaco example. The wealth and the opportunities are simply too great, and people don't want to go back. Once they've experienced Bitcoin, once they've experienced the internet, whatever it is, they're not going to go back to, you know, being clamped down and having their sources of information, their sources of money and whatever controlled by the government. I think there will be other governments, as we even see now. I mean, there's still places like North Korea. I think not to over-dramatize the example, but I think many countries that won't go for free cities will continue to clamp down as they do, and they're going to continue to have that iron grip on control and power, and that, you know, that's why they won't have free cities, and it's also why, you know, the people in that country will either have to flee or unfortunately live under, you know, more poverty and tyrannical situations.
So we should choose wisely moving forward. Choose our countries wisely. Well, Alex, thanks, mate. That was a phenomenal conversation. I loved the broadness of your understanding of this whole thing. It's very invigorating to hear you be able to answer literally every single question I have, but you are one of the kind of pros in this space, so thanks for coming in. Really I think this is going to be a super informative episode for people, so many thanks
for having me.